A summer job can teach us lots of things: how to work a cash register, how to make latte art, how to dig a trench, or it could make us question our ideas about race and ageing and our own family history. When journalist Kirsten Drysdale took a phone call from a friend about a short-term gig in Kenya, there were many things she didn't know about it. For example, that it might lead to being chased around a mansion on a grand colonial estate by an old man with a nine iron. But life is full of surprises. Kirsten, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's set the scene. You're a fairly nice girl from Mackay in Queensland, but you're living in Kenya in this mansion, and you're being paid to look after an elderly man who's coming at you with a golf club as you try and dodge him. How did you get there?
Look, the short answer is I was sort of tricked. My friend had called up, as he said, with this offer of what she termed a very cruisy gig, glorified babysitting, you know, looking after a sweet old man with dementia. It turned out he was a little bit more of a handful than that. He chased me around the house with a golf club and a garden hoe and a vacuum cleaner on multiple occasions, usually because I wouldn't give him the car keys. He was always wanting to jump into his car and drive off, but the problem with that was, well, he probably couldn't even drive anymore. He was 83, but also in his mind, it was 1965 and he was in England, or it was, you know, 1950 and he was in the Kenyan Highlands in the middle of the Mau Mau uprising. So we couldn't very well let him get in the car and drive through the gates into 2010 modern Nairobi traffic.
So I'm wondering at what point you got worried about what you hadn't been told. Was it when you arrived and heard they'd been looking for people with thick skins and nous, perhaps?
It was pretty much upon touchdown in Kenya. So my friend, who was already there working for the family in the house, she met me at the airport, and on the drive back to the house, she kind of confessed that things were perhaps a little bit more complicated than she'd made out. She explained that the man's daughter, who was the one who had hired us and was arranging his care, actually suspected that his wife, her stepmother, was trying to kill him. So the daughter had, there were sort of like secret cameras installed throughout the house, and we were there, as it turned out, not just to look after this old man, Walt, but to spy on his allegedly murderous wife and report back to the daughter with everything we overheard, no matter how trivial it might seem.
And the daily routine of care as well was quite detailed. Walk us through what Fiona, the daughter, told you to do when you first got there.
Yeah, it was extremely, extremely detailed. So everything from in the morning, we were to, lay out his soap, his razor, everything into the exact position on the ledge under the mirror. So much, you know, even to the degree of turning the hot tap 30 degrees to the left, because that would mean the temperature was just right, you know, not too hot, not too cold. We had to lay his clothes out onto the bed in the reverse order of how he would need to put them on, help tie his shoelaces, then walk him through to breakfast. And, you know, even his meals were very, very controlled. So we were trying to restrict the amount of sugar he had, but also the amount of salt he had. He wasn't allowed alcohol. So at nighttime at dinner, instead of pouring him a glass of wine, we would pour him a glass of Ribena, which had been decanted into an old bottle of wine. So he thought he was having wine. When we were giving him his, you know, sundowner shandies, as the old colonials always enjoyed, it was actually 0% alcohol beer with an empty bottle of actual Tusker, which is the real Kenyan beer, put next to it to kind of help with the ruse. His gin and tonic at night was just tonic with a little bit of gin wiped around the edge of the glass so that he kind of got a whiff of alcohol as he raised it to his lips.
I guess there's a lot of care going into that, isn't there? There's a lot of love, in a way, into that artifice of trying to convince him he's having this lovely life he thinks he's having.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she was devoted. She was, I mean, really to the extreme degree devoted. She even, I remember, told us which arm to help him into his shirts first. It was his left arm first, or because he'd had a pacemaker installed and he wasn't quite as flexible on one side as the other. So, you know, that was the level of degree that she wanted us to look at. You know, where exactly on the patio to put his chair so that it would catch just the right amount of sunlight in the afternoon. Those sorts of things. So, yeah, I mean, it was real true, you know, love and devotion.
There are also very strange moments when you did find yourself abetting Fiona in her surveillance of Marguerite, the wife. Mm-hmm. You had to burn things at the bottom of the garden?
Oh, gosh. She, the daughter was, look, in my view, a little bit paranoid about the wife and kind of wrong about the wife's intentions. I don't think the wife bore any ill will to her husband at all. She certainly wasn't trying to kill him as far as I could tell. But, yeah, Fiona was convinced of this and would even have us try and get Walt to write letters that were saying that he didn't want his wife to have any control of his travel documents. And now this man is 83 and, you know, with quite advanced dementia, so he didn't really know what he was writing. But she had us sit at the dining room with him and have him write these letters out, and we had to do it a few times over because he wasn't as practiced with writing anymore. Then she sent me with the, you know, the scrap pages down to the bottom of the garden, all scrunched up with some pills in the middle, which I still to this day have no idea what they were. And yeah, and put them into the garden fire where all the household rubbish was burnt at the end of every day. And I just felt at that moment that was fairly not long after my arrival there, and I just thought, what have I gotten myself into? I half expected a kind of camera to emerge from the garden and someone to tell me I'd been punked.
Well, and I should clarify that Kirsten Drysdale has written a book about this amazing experience, I Built No Schools in Kenya. But Kirsten, it's full of these amazing, very funny in a lot of ways, images, you know, the cliched colonial mansion, the actual stuffed lion on the wall that Walt had battled in his younger days. But with that goes a lot of racial politics, and that's going to make some people really uncomfortable reading the book. And it made you uncomfortable too. Tell us what was going on in that household.
So, yeah, it was very uncomfortable because, and especially because of this particular scenario, it's the man with dementia. So he's living in the past a lot of the time. In his mind, it was pre-independence era Kenya. So he, you know, we had seven domestic staff, all African, obviously, you know, a cook, a gardener, a driver, a maid, a caretaker, a security guard, all the rest of it. So whenever we left the house and, you know, went into modern day Kenya, he was a little bit confused by, you know, these new standards of equality and racial harmony that didn't exist in his day. And there would be occasions where, so he was a member of a local country club, a life member. Now, this was a very iconic colonial establishment back in the day. It was obviously a whites-only institution. These days, it's open to all races, as it should be. But we'd walk into the building and he would be so confused by the sight of black people and Indian people and Asian people, you know, sitting at the dining room table. And he'd kind of look at me in horror and say, well, what's going on here? They've really let the standards drop. And I would just be appalled and mortified and, you know, kind of angry. But then I had to remind myself, well, he's a man from another time, another place, and in his mind, he hasn't been with the last 50 years of history. So, yeah, they were kind of quite difficult scenarios to navigate.
And also at the same time, you're going through some discoveries about your own family history. Tell us where your parents came from when they moved to Australia.
Yeah, so my parents are from Zimbabwe. They arrived in Australia. Well, I mean, at the time they were there, it was Rhodesia, one of the last holdouts in Africa, you know, before giving in to independence. And so they arrived in Australia in 1980, which was when Zimbabwe became Zimbabwe. And I guess I hadn't really thought about things all that much. I mean, we grew up in Mackay. I knew my parents were from Africa, but I just felt like I was an Australian kid. We didn't have any other really African friends or anything like that, other than all of our family members and the history was from Zimbabwe. And so I guess it was only once I went back to Kenya, it was part of why I was interested in going, was a curiosity about this sort of strange colonial place that they had come from that just didn't seem like it could really exist. It sort of only existed in myths and stories and films for me. So it was partly why I wanted to go back and see what that world was like.
It's really interesting that you decided that going to Kenya to work for a senile colonial would be a really good way to rediscover that family history.
In a lot of ways, it was. I mean, I know, you know, Kenya is a different country to Zimbabwe. It's, you know, thousands of kilometres away. But that British colonial lifestyle, which this man in particular was living, certainly bore some similarities to the world that my parents would have grown up in.
And you stumbled on a cousin working in a bar there and did discover some, I guess, revisions about your understanding of your family history. Walk us through that.
So my cousin, it was my father's cousin, so my second cousin, I think that's how that works. They ran a bar on the other side of Nairobi, which by complete coincidence I'd been frequenting with some friends who worked at the Australian High Commission. And it was one of my aunts back here in Australia had been working on the family tree, discovered this long lost connection, contacted me because she knew I was in Kenya and said, oh, you know, they're running this bar, it's called Kengelly's in Lavington. And I was like, what, really? That's where I've been going for beers, you know? And so next time I was there, I asked to speak to the manager and out came this, you know, this woman, and she sort of thought, oh, is everything okay? And I said, yeah, everything's fine. I think we're cousins. So that was, you know, that was just a crazy coincidence, but it was actually a lovely little turn of fortune because I got to meet her. I got to meet her husband, her children who were in primary school at the time growing up in Kenya, and having a very different experience to what she and my parents' generation would have had in Africa, because her kids, you know, the school they were at was entirely mixed race, you know, all whites, blacks, Indians, Asians, all together, all friends, no segregation. It was a lovely thing to see that's how the future of that country is going.
But it sounded like the story you'd kind of inherited from your parents was a largely hassle-free migration, and you discovered that it might have been slightly different.
Oh, well, it was, I guess they never really talked about it that much, but after Rhodesia at the time had a very ugly civil war for 10 years, and at the end of it, there was a bit of a hurry to get out of there if you'd been on the wrong side of history, which most white people were. They were, you know, they were conscripted into the Rhodesian army. It wasn't really like they had a lot of choice. And, you know, there was a pretty big fear of reprisals, and a lot of people had to get the hell out of there very quickly in 1980.
When you came back, Kirsten, you write that you started to reassess things in Australia in terms of our race relations. What came up for you then?
I think it was more just a bit of perspective on the world that I hadn't had before. I realised that, you know, we talk about privilege a lot, and white privilege in particular, which is very much a thing that exists, but I saw it suddenly very starkly for what it was. So my parents arrived in Australia virtually penniless. They had no money to their name. They started out, you know, from the bottom, and they've done very, very well for themselves. They've had extremely good fortune, you know, business success. They've made it here. But I know that would not have been the case had they been black Africans who'd come over and tried to set up in central Queensland. Or, you know, almost certainly wouldn't have had as easy a time as they did. So in one sense, I'm like, you know, well, they did struggle. They arrived in a new country completely on their own, no money. They had to work very, very hard their whole lives. And of course, they should be given due credit for that. But also, you can't separate that from the fact that their skin colour made that much easier for them to do than it is for other people who come here, and especially in a place like Central Queensland where there's not so much racial diversity, are trying to do the same thing.
It's a really fascinating and fun read, but obviously there's so much going on under the surface. I'll just pricey some of it for our listeners. You eventually quit the job, but then you return. Just tell us quickly why you returned.
I returned because I'd really, really fallen in love with Kenya. It really is. I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it's a magical place, and Africa can really kind of get in under your skin and into your blood. And I felt like I wanted to go back. I hadn't finished my time there. There were other things I wanted to do. I was really desperate to try and do a bit of freelance journalism as well. And the family had assured me that if I came back, I wouldn't be dragged into all this insane drama and spying and surveillance and, you know, going behind people's backs and that kind of stuff. They promised me that was all sorted out, and it would be a much more simple time, and I'd be able to do all these other things.
Well, they seem very trustworthy.
Very trustworthy. I mean, fool me once, you know, fool me twice. This was on me. So I went back, and it was okay for a little while, and then things just kind of spiraled out of control again. And this time, unfortunately, the security situation in the country was deteriorating. There were terrorist attacks being launched by Al-Shabaab, the terrorist group based in Somalia, which Kenya borders with. And then the Kenyan army decided to retaliate by invading Somalia. Well, Al-Shabaab didn't take too kindly to that. So, everything just kind of unraveled. And within the house as well, it eventually got to a point where I was like, it's really time to go home to Australia.
Well, and I'm sad that we don't have time to cover in detail the pharmaceutical coping strategies that you and your friend Ruby adopted and thankfully emerged unscathed from. But I'm wondering, Kirsten, if you'd tell us what you feel you learned looking back on that experience. Would you have done anything differently?
Oh, look, probably I wouldn't. If I'd known in advance how tricky the situation was, I probably wouldn't have gone. But it was one of those things where I don't regret it at all. It was such a rich experience, even though it was very difficult at times. I think one of the things I've really, really learned is about making your end of life wishes known to your family, writing an advance care directive, making sure everyone knows exactly where you stand, exactly how you want to be looked after when it gets to the point that you can't, express that anymore. If you get dementia and actually aren't of sound mind to make those wishes known, you need to make them known in advance, because all of the family drama was based on a difference of opinion between this man's wife and his daughter on how he should be looked after. And I really think it wouldn't have ever gotten to that point if he'd been able to make his wishes known earlier.
Yeah, you don't want to be sitting at a table having your wishes ghostwritten by your daughter via a kind of human Ouija board of an Australian personal carer. Kirsten Drysdale, thanks so much for a really interesting romp through, the stuffed lion territory and the territory of race politics too. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Kirsten Drysdale, I Built No Schools in Kenya is the title of the book. She's a journalist and television presenter, and the book's out now. You're listening to Life Matters.